Ramiro Fernandez is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Hernandez to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell. Houston Vigil reporter, Dave Atwood. Tonight's featured guest is Keir Weibel, a law professor at Cornell, where students and faculty have fought to save Hernandez from execution. The execution watch for Ramiro Hernandez begins.
And good evening, this is Ray Hill, and it is April the 9th. 2014, it is 6 p.m. Texas has scheduled to execute someone in the killing house in Huntsville. Ramiro Hernandez is tonight's subject. We've spent a good bit of work. The legal team has spent a good bit of work studying this case, and they have some issues to talk to about this case. We hope you will find that interesting. Now would be a good time for you to notify your friends that wherever they may be, that Execution Watch is on the air. And so you can use that back channel on personal media and get word out. We got word this week that KPFT's largest weekday internet audience occurs when Execution Watch is on the air. We're very honored to have that audience, and a good bit of that audience is overseas, and we welcome all you folks listening. As a piece of programming note, Pat Hartwell is standing by in Huntsville, so before I go to her, I wanted to tell everybody that on the 30th of April, there is a scheduled execution. I don't know exactly who that is, but it's going to be difficult for the broadcast audience to hear that execution because KPFT will be in its fundraising mode. And when that happens, Execution Watch is relegated to HD channel. Those of you who listen to us over the internet, that will not affect your being able to hear the show. It will just affect the guys on the row being able to hear it and other that. And as soon as fundraising is over, we'll be back in the studio, which gives me occasion to remind you that radio station KPFT is a listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio station, and we would not be able to do this program on any other station that I know of. I have talked to other non-commercial stations, and they're not really interested, and I don't think this would make a commercially viable thing for commercial radio, so we continue here, but we're only able to do that because of your generous support for the station. And incidentally, that's tax deductible if that makes a difference to you. Okay, let's get Pat on the air and see what's going on in Huntsville. Hello, Pat, this is Ray.
Hey, Ray, how are you tonight?
I'm very well.
We're in a very sad boat up here at the walls.
What's going on up there?
Well, we have about 16 or 17 protesters, but what is so impressive, I have counted 10 different media outlets here. We want to always tell the media we are grateful for anything that they do to tell the world about the death penalty in Texas. We have Telemundo, Laredo, El Mañana, Semana News, Univision, Televisia, which is the Latin American largest network. We have MSV, which is a radio in Mexico, TV Azteca, and Radio Formula out of Mexico. We also have Linda Pullman here, who is representing a German radio station. And, of course, we have the AP here, and we have the representatives of the Mexican government, which I have already apologized on the behalf of all of the Texans who are
on behalf of real,
for this.
Real Texans as opposed to the politicians.
Exactly.
Can you tell us something about the witnesses?
Yes, the witnesses just crossed. It was media that just crossed. I understand that Mr. Hernandez has a spiritual advisor that he allowed. I have not seen any of his family. I do not know if any of his family is at the hospitality house or not.
I think the record would show that Ramiro Hernandez is a Mexican national.
Yes, he not only is a Mexican national, he was unfortunately raised on top of a toxic waste dump when he was a child. He was mentally retarded, where his own father referred to him as a burro. He had a very hard life, and he escaped here to the U.S. looking for a better life, and unfortunately, this is what happened.
Pat, your organizational connection was Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement?
It is, and we want to take the opportunity to give a shout-out to all the guys on the row, the guys that are friends and acquaintance of Mr. Hernandez. We extend our sympathies, our thoughts, and condolences. Please know that we, along with all the other organizations, are always thinking of y'all up there on the row. You know, we stay busy, but don't hesitate to write any of us anytime you need anything. And I also want to say to them, always, guys, keep your head high and your spirits up. You mentioned a while ago, Ray, that there was an execution on the 30th. I don't have that listed.
Okay, well, I just got
talking about a fundraiser.
That may be something that we want to check. I just got that coming in the studio because I was concerned about overlap between execution watch and fundraising season.
It may be. You know, I haven't checked it since last night, so the state of Texas might have added somebody.
I do know that next week they're killing Jose Villegas.
Yes, they and are. And then Robert Campbell is on May the 13th, and Robert Pruitt is scheduled for May the 21st. Of course, we always hoping for a stay for any of the guys.
Well, I have a video of an interview with Jose and with Pruitt, and so there will be cameras here, and this will also be televised.
That's wonderful. Pruitt is an innocent man.
I believe that. After interviewing him, I believe that to be true as well, Pat. Pat, how do Free World people get in touch with your organization?
We are on Facebook under the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. We have an open group, which is the picture with the gavel. Send your name, and I'm the one that approves you, so I'll sure do it. And we also have a informational group, which has our symbol on it. You can also reach us at, of course, www.abolitionmovement.org.
Thank you very much, Pat. Keep us informed about what goes on, and our regards to the vigilance.
Thank you very much, Ray. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And that was Pat Hartwell reporting from Huntsville, Texas. Jim, this is not a very pretty case.
Well, apart from being pretty, as you said before, this man was a Mexican national and escaped from prison in Mexico and ended up in what we call the Hill Country. And those not from Texas. It's a little area outside of San Antonio and Austin. It's referred to the Hill Country. And in that little town called Kerrville, which isn't a very hospitable place. In fact, it was the first city in Texas I can remember they put up in future Earl Warren signs. It's pretty conservative up there. And while he was there, he was working as a day laborer, and he went to work as a carpenter, doing some carpenter work. And he ended up doing some carpenter work, and we're having kind of a dispute of the man's name. It's L-I-C-H. I think it's pronounced Litch, and some people say Lick, but it was a gentleman named Litch, a 46-year-old man. He was quite accomplished. He spoke something like 7 different languages.
80 years old, wasn't he?
No, he's 47.
47?
Uh-huh. And what happened, he always had been a professor at Baylor. He was a professor at at Shriner Institute. He'd written some books and was quite well known up in that part of the country. In fact, he was an 8th generation person living in that country. And he had what they referred to as a ranch. And what happened, he hired Mr. Hernandez to do some work for him, doing some carpenter work. And after that was over with, Hernandez came by later and wanted some help and wanted to know if he could stay in a cabin that the Litches had on their property. And he agreed to do so. Mr. Litch said he agreed to do that and let him stay there and do day work for him and do work for other people. He'd been there about 2 weeks, and apparently during that interim period of time, and I never could find out why, he apparently got mad at the Liches for some reason. He talked to a cousin, said he was mad at them, and talked about the fact the Liches had a car that he could steal and take to Mexico, and there's something kicked him off, and I never could find out what. But nonetheless, around 10 o'clock one night, he goes up to the Liches house, and in the house is Lich, his wife, and Mrs. Lich's elderly mother staying there with them. And he asked Mr. Lich to come out on the porch, and then they disappear. They walk off. And when they get away from the house, he picks up a piece of rebar. Some people say a crowbar, but most of the opinions say a piece of rebar. He began to beat Mr. Lich in the head, and back to beat him so badly, according to the deputy sheriff who examined the body, said you couldn't recognize it as being a head, but he beat him up pretty severely and killed him. He then goes back to the house, gets into the house, ties Mrs. Lich to the bed, sexually assaults her with a knife, and I say tied her up, and then he said if that she would come up with at least $15,000, he'd bring the husband back alive. He had the husband hidden off somewhere and tried to get some money out of her. And then at that point, he went outside, started the car. They had a car he was apparently planning to steal. Started the car up, then went back in the house, untied Mrs. Lich, and raped her a second time. And then he went to sleep after that. And then she managed to free herself from the restraints. And he also threatened her in that period of time.
He went to sleep in the house?
Went to sleep in the house. After
car running outside?
Car running outside. And so he goes to sleep. And she managed to escape and ran to some neighbors and notified the neighbors. And that's how he was caught.
So this is not an isolated ranch. It might explain what hill country ranches are about.
And Kerrville is a big kind of big retirement area. And anybody has 5 or 10 acres, they call it a ranch. And it's really not a ranch. And up in really where ranches really exist up in the Panhandle, that'd be a front lawn. But they call it a ranch. Even Gary Trichter has a ranch in Bandera, and it's about 20 acres.
Okay.
You would think it was a ponderosa here.
His office yard is bigger than that.
Of course it is. But anyway, that's pretty much the case. And there was never much doubt about his guilt.
Any priors on this guy?
Oh, yeah.
What did he went to Mexico prison for?
Susan's going to talk about the priors. He went to Mexico prison for another, believe it or not, another beating, killing. He killed somebody and beat him to death in Nuevo Laredo and got a 25-year sentence in Mexico. And that's where he escaped.
Susan, what you got?
Okay. Well, at the punishment phase of the trial, the state puts on evidence that he was in Mexico, that he was sentenced to 25 years for the bludgeoning death of somebody in his hometown in Nuevo Laredo. He escapes from prison in Mexico, and then he comes to Texas, ends up in the Hill Country. And there's another woman testifies that when she was 15, that she knew him as the brother of a friend of hers, and that she accepted a ride from him to go get a hamburger, but he took her to a ranch where he was working and raped her. He also, threatened her that if she told anyone that he would kill her and her mother. While he was awaiting trial, while he was in custody in jail, he apparently was angry that he didn't get eggs for breakfast, and he had a prison, a jail-made shank, and he attacked one of the jailers, and apparently it took several jailers to subdue him. So those are like the past, the past misdeeds and crimes that came out at punishment. Also,
but he was convicted and went to a Mexican prison.
Yes,
for 25 years.
Well, he didn't. He escaped from the Mexican prison.
He escaped. Of course, you understand that in Mexican prisons you can get kicked out.
He wouldn't kick out, though. He wouldn't kick out.
They could just run your ass off if you don't.
Run your what off?
Your butt off.
Okay, right. Okay.
No, you can say that. It's one of the seven. Okay. That's not the seven deadly words.
Okay.
I don't want to get in trouble here.
Also, Miss Lick, the widow of Glenn Lick's widow, also testified that at some point he made a gesture as if he was injecting a needle into his arm and said, "It doesn't matter to me." Obviously, the inference is if I get the death penalty, it doesn't matter to me.
Okay.
That also came out.
That was in the trial. Hold on. We've got Dave Atwood is calling in. Dave, this is Ray. Where are you?
Hi, Ray. Well, we're over here in the museum district, corner of Main and Benz. But believe it or not, we're just gathering now because the presidential motorcade came right through this area.
Oh, okay. I understand.
And it was just all blocked off and just a total mess over here. Oh. So, but we are gathering now, and we'll be here, you know, at least till 6:30.
Well, I'm kind of sorry that you didn't get your message of hope for life and respect for life to a passing president. That seemed to me like a worthy cause.
Well, it would be, because I have ridden him two or three times over the last couple of 3 years and asked him when he was going to speak out, and the response that I get is that basically he wants the death penalty to be carried out justly, but he didn't talk about being against it, which is very disturbing to me. And so I would encourage anybody that's listening tonight to write the president and ask him, he's in his second term, ask him why he can't speak out against the death penalty. What's wrong with him? And also mass incarceration. I mean, he needs to speak out on these issues if he's a person that cares about human rights. And I don't know. You know, I wish we had had our banner out here when they went by, but we couldn't even get through because all the traffic was blocked off. But I would encourage people to write President Obama and say, come on now, if you are truly interested in human rights, let's do something about the human rights issues that we have right here in our country.
Eric Holder is giving us a little bit of lip services, but we're not getting much from the top.
No. So, but anyway, we'll be here till at least another 15 minutes. What's going on up in Huntsville?
Well, the witnesses have crossed the road, and that was anticipated. They're representative from the Mexican government up there, as well as a great deal of Spanish-speaking media from both sides of the border covering this case.
Right. This is the second Mexican national that will be executed in Texas this year alone. This is incredibly horrible. All executions are horrible, but this is the fact that we're executing a citizen from another country again is very, very horrible. And
Dave, how do folks get in touch with your organization?
Go to the website, which is TCADP.org. And that's the best way. And
that is an acronym for Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
Correct.
Okay.
We have a local chapter and chapters throughout the state, but this is, of course, here today we are the local chapter in Houston, plus other friends having the vigil out here.
How many folks you got with you out there today?
Well, we've got four, but there are some that are over in the parking lot trying to figure out how to get over here.
around presidential prestige.
Yeah, right.
Thank you, Dave. Give our regards to the vigilant.
Okay, you take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Susan, we'll get back to you.
Okay, I would also like to add that there was no issue of mental retardation raised at trial, at guilt or innocence or punishment, or at any phase of the trial. That was not raised at trial. Of course, it was not, obviously could not be raised on appeal, and that came up later in the post-conviction writ process.
Jim, you got any speculation why that wasn't raised?
Well, in this particular case, Ray, mental retardation cuts two ways. We've talked about this before, and back then, they didn't have, the Atkins case hadn't come out, and that was not.
Oh, okay.
So that wasn't there.
This is pre-Atkins.
Right, and the problem is when you're in front of a jury, especially in a Central Texas jury, when you're proving somebody's mentally retarded, you're also proving some incentive to give them the death penalty because they say that person can't be fixed, and that sometimes works just the opposite against you. And in this case, obviously the juror is really upset because the case was so well publicized and bad, they changed venue from Kerr County to Bandera County. And it took the jury 5 minutes to find him guilty after a lengthy trial. We're talking about 5 minutes, walk in, barely have time to get a form.
When they do a change of venue like that from Kerrville to Bandera,
mm-hmm.
A Bandera judge hears this, not a Kerr?
Oftentimes, the judge from Kerr County will go with the case, and sometimes they'll let the local judge do it. But usually, if it's a nice area like Bandera, they're going to go there because they want to get a vacation. So in Harris County, when they transfer these cases on change of venue,
the judges
go with them. It's a paid vacation for them. Because, for example, the last time we had a change of venue here, they went from Houston to a little town in Fredericksburg. And so they like that.
And they also are rather partial to that restaurant, that town with all the good German restaurants.
Well, that they get per diem pay, too. They get some extra money, so they enjoy that.
But the point of changing the venue is to get a different jury pool. The assumption that the case was so, shall we say, well-known, publicized, that it's a, you know, obviously small community, the victim was a well-known person in the community. So the it would be hard probably to get a jury in Kerr County that hadn't already heard of the case and perhaps formed an opinion on the case. That's the basis of the change of venue. It doesn't have anything to do with the judge. It's the jury pool.
But you would have perhaps a judge from Kerr County over listening to hearing a case in Bandera, Texas, before a Bandera jury.
Yes, yes. It's now, to change your jury pool.
So if the jury comes back in 5 minutes with the guilt,
yes,
part of the phrase, then that didn't even spend enough time to elect a foreman. They just become kind of a mob.
Well, that the guilt or innocence, it took them 5 minutes. On punishment, it took them an hour.
Okay.
This was a quick trial when you have a guilty verdict in an hour, less than verdict 5 minutes, and give a death penalty in less than an hour, about an hour.
Pretty quick stuff.
Yeah, very quick.
But to not have even raised the issue, how do you preserve that for appeal if you don't raise it?
Well, what you have to do is come back on the post-conviction writ. Because those of you from our audience aren't familiar with our procedure, when you do a direct appeal, what we call a direct appeal, going to the Court of Criminal Appeals from a trial, you can only raise issues that are raised at the trial level.
Sure.
And so in this case, mental retardation was not raised at trial and was not discussed in the direct appeal. But we have a post-conviction writ procedure where you can come back in on things that were not discussed at trial. And they gave him a pretty thorough hearing because Larry's going to discuss part of that, and Mike's going to discuss some, and Jack's going to discuss some. Because we have a pretty thorough writ hearing, and they hashed this out pretty well in a writ hearing in front of a district court judge to determine whether or not, in fact, he was mentally retarded.
Elizabeth, is there anything else in the guilt or innocent phase or in the sentencing phase that you want to bring to our attention?
Susan, not that you said. He said Elizabeth meant Susan.
Susan, anything else there you want to bring our attention to?
No, I think that's kind of covered it for punishment.
Larry, you going to pick up the writ?
I'll pick up talking about the mental retardation or intellectually disabled issue.
Okay.
As Jim and you have already talked about, Jim have talked about Ray. This case, the Hernandez case, was tried in 2000, and that was prior to the Supreme Court determining that we could it was cruel and unusual punishment to execute mentally retarded people. When Atkins was decided by the Supreme Court, they left it to the states to determine how to go about applying the Atkins requirement. Now, the Texas legislature did not act on that matter. So the Court of Criminal Appeals, in a case called Briceño in 2004, laid out the way to determine the factors to determine whether a person was indeed mentally retarded. And those factors, as we've discussed before, three primary factors, and that is a significantly sub-average general intellectual functioning. Normally, if you've got an IQ of 70 or below, that's typically okay, but not necessarily. But the real test is significantly sub-average general intellectual functioning, accompanied by reduced capacity for adaptive skills. And that's broken down into about seven different factors about how the adaptive skills are determined or evaluated. And then finally, the onset of which has to occur before the age of 18. Those are the essential Briceño factors. Now, because Briceño had not been decided prior to the Hernandez case, the writ lawyers looked back and tried to determine how to, in order to, at the writ level, what the court allowed them to do was to actually have a hearing with live testimony to determine to prove up the Briceño factors. And so they called in psychologists, called in people who know Briceño, who knew Hernandez as a boy to determine, you know, when did people think that he was retarded coming up. That's the adaptive skills, adaptive factors. But still, even with the – there was a writ hearing in 2006 and then a final writ hearing in 2008. So my concern is always that a person be given due process. It appears that Hernandez was at least given technical due process, and that the decision was actually looked at.
In an earlier discussion of this case, this is a rather elaborate course of action, right?
His action
under the crime itself shows some planning.
That's one of the factors under the now, adaptive skills.
It does not occur to me that it's real smart in the middle of all of that to say, gosh, I need a nap. Who?
That's the guest for tonight, the featured guest.
Oh, okay, sure, okay. So how smart is it to stop in the middle of all of this elaborate planning and say it's nap time?
Well, and at the writ hearing, Ray, what was done is they went through all of the adaptive skills factors, and that was just one of the factors. So for instance, they had people who knew him growing up to come forward and talk about, did people who knew him growing up actually think he was retarded? That was a factor.
Let's bring the professor in at this point. Professor?
Yes.
You looked at this case?
I have looked at this case. I should say I've never been Mr. Hernandez's lawyer directly, but one of my colleagues at Cornell has represented him and represented him up to this day. And so I've absorbed some of the information, you might say, by osmosis, and I've also certainly had sort of conversations with her about the case and read a good many of the materials associated with it.
Well, coming from Cornell, you're probably familiar with some of these laws all over the country. Is Texas law unusual when it comes to the issue of mental capacity?
Well, it is. The Briceño factors are a bit unusual. Someone mentioned earlier that the Supreme Court in Atkins left it to the states to sort of come up with their own procedures for implementing the Atkins rule. And Texas, which is somewhat of a tradition in Texas, they did a similar thing back when it was time to reinstate the death penalty back in the early 1970s. They sort of went their own way. And the Briceño factors don't really have, I would say, any kind of clear analog really anywhere else in the country.
Okay. Do you have an opinion
about the Briceño factors?
Yeah.
Well, I think they've done a lot to distort intellectual disability inquiries in a lot of cases. There, my understanding, though, in Hernandez's case, is that it wasn't so much Briceño that sort of led the state habeas court astray. I think it had more to do with, sort of the basic state post-conviction review principle that the process is really only as good as the author of the findings at the end of the process, or the quality of the findings at the end of the process. And this has long been a problem in Texas, and it's a problem in a good many other places as well, which is you can put on really all the credible, relevant, probative evidence that you want. But at some point, that information is going to be reduced to a set of findings. And those findings are pretty close to written in stone as far as that case is concerned going forward. And the trouble comes when a party is allowed to write those findings. And my understanding in this case is that the state's lawyers were allowed to write those findings, or at least allowed to propose findings that the judge adopted nearly wholesale. And so there was, as I understand it, some very credible and very powerful evidence presented in support of the proposition that Mr. Hernandez, in fact, was intellectually disabled, and most of that was neutralized or written out of the
but
case.
But all of this happened in writ hearings.
Correct.
It wasn't part of the trial. Do you have any idea of why at least there wouldn't have been some raising of the issue of mental capacity in the course of trial?
Well, in this case, it's my understanding that his trial lawyers really wouldn't have had any idea to begin that process because they conducted almost no investigation of his background. And as someone mentioned earlier in the show, this was a pre-Atkins trial. So the value, if you will, proving a client's or a defendant's intellectual disability was very different, you know, and was
well,
much less.
One of the things that Jim brought to the table in an earlier discussion in this case, I'm speaking about Joan Skelton, who's kind of a lead role here on their lawyers, was that a judge in a case where a jury of voters was out for 5 minutes and came back with a guilty verdict and then out for another hour and came back with a death sentence, that judge, considering these factors, is pretty much predisposed not to be in a neutral position to analyze all of this if he's in an elected process like we are in Texas. Is there a more objective way to look at mental capacity issues than the one structured under Texas penal law?
Well, sure. You can pick your judges a different way and remove them, or at least do something to insulate them from that kind of political pressure. But in addition to that, there is some objectivity, or at least potential for objectivity, built into the system in that something like intellectual disability, usually when that is hashed out in something like a writ hearing, there's expert testimony, right? I mean, it's not something that usually the layperson, the person who's not trained in those kind of assessments, can't just sort of eyeball somebody and say, well, yes, this person is disabled, no, this person is not. There's testing, there's well-established methodologies for assessing a person's functioning, intellectual functioning, adaptive behavior, that sort of thing. And, you know, so both sides sort of bring in the information, hopefully do a competent job of that, and then at some point you have to rely on the decision maker to decide who's right or which way the evidence or the weight of the evidence leans. In this case, as I understand it, there were, I believe, three very well-qualified experts who testified to the information showing that Mr. Hernandez, in fact, was intellectually disabled. And on the state side, they brought in someone who literally could not state the three diagnostic criteria for mental retardation, did not speak, read, or understand Spanish, and all of the testing was conducted in Spanish, and had never met Mr. Hernandez. His testimony was allowed to essentially negate all of the testimony on the other side.
All of this professional information then is distilled into, in an adversarial process, to the judge who makes the decision and may not even be in a neutral position to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but as I said, you know, the outcome of the process is only as good as that final step, which is the making of the findings, because the law that then governs how the case will be dealt with from that point forward, strongly presumes those findings to be correct. Makes it very difficult to overcome them. And that, I think, is one of the stories of this case.
Well, do you think that, from your perspective in Cornell University, do you think that the rest of the country looks at Texas process as kind of frontier-esque medieval stuff?
I think that, yes, that opinion is certainly held by some who are familiar with the process. I should say, unfortunately, the practice of allowing lawyers for the prosecution to formulate the findings is not exclusive to Texas. It happens in other places as well. I think, you know, maybe one of the big differences in Texas is the sheer volume of cases, capital cases, in which the process ends that way.
Do you think that what we're doing here, exposing on the occasion of Mr. Hernandez's demise, some of the facts of the case, do you think that has any value in anything?
Well, I would hope so. I would hope that listeners will maybe hear something they haven't heard before and gain a little bit better understanding of how this process works. You know, it's very common, particularly for politicians, governors, at the end of the review process to talk about how many judges have signed off on a death sentence in a particular case, as if that somehow lends real weight or real credibility to the outcome. But when you sort of peel back the veneer and examine exactly what those judges were looking at, to me, I think that really lessens the value of that. of that number that politicians like to rely upon. So I would hope people hearing this will begin to maybe question a little bit those kinds of statements, because they don't really say as much as the people who make them want them to say.
Professor Weber, thank you very much for joining Execution Watch tonight.
Okay, thank you.
We may exploit you again. And that was the professor. Thank you very much. Jim, I get sometimes the impression that this is a few lines from Eleanor Rigby.
Well, there's a few corrections. Number one, it's an obvious conflict of interest for the trial judge who heard the trial and knew what the jury did to later come back and sit as the writ judge, because he's already heard the case, he's already got his
Does
mind.
Does that happen in every case?
Every case, unless the judge is defeated, because when you file a post-conviction writ, it goes back to that district court. Unless that judge is defeated, the judge who heard the case is going to hear the writ. Now, judges do have the authority to appoint other. They can appoint a lawyer to hear a writ if they choose to do so, but most of them will hear it themselves. In this particular case, you've got a judge, an elected judge in Texas, who is sitting on a case, and he has to decide who is truthful, who's more credible, the defense psychiatrist or the state psychiatrist. And something else that the professor is not aware of that makes it especially more acute, as a general rule in these smaller towns, the judge had been the former DA. The path to politics here is going to work as a DA's office. And oftentimes, the prosecutor in front of him.
I think that's required in Montgomery County.
Well, and oftentimes, I'm not saying it happened in this case, but oftentimes, the prosecutor that's arguing for the state was hired by the judge when the judge was a DA. It's kind of like a family reunion. And he's going to get a better audience, obviously. Now, what will happen when there's a contest, like in this case, state psychiatrists say he's normal, defense psychiatrists say he's mentally handicapped? The judge has to decide who's telling the truth. Now, both sides will submit some proposed findings of facts, conclusions of law. Both sides will submit them. And the judge can choose among those findings.
He can take some of this and some of that, or he can take all of this and none of that.
That's right. But as a general rule, and not in a great majority of the cases, they adopted exactly what the state wants.
Pat, you're back on the air.
Hi, Ray. The witnesses have come out, and right now all of us are milling around because the representatives from the Mexican government, including the consular that's based here in Houston, has asked us to stand by with our signs and with our support when the press comes down and they give their official statement about this illegal killing.
So you're being actually exploited for the occasion. Congratulations.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way it is.
Well, I hate to be laughing. I hate to be laughing on this sad occasion, but.
Yeah, I know. I would like to give a shout out to the guys on the roll again, and I want to tell everyone that Gus Garcia had sent us a beautiful poem called Tempted. He sent us one in English and in Spanish. I read the English version, and Jesus, who is the brother of Juan Valderas, who just got sent to death row a couple of weeks ago from Harris County, read the Spanish version. So thank you, Gus, and all the guys on the road, please keep your head up and your spirits high.
Okay, Pat,
we're behind you.
There's one other show business thing that I've got to talk about. Next execution is going to be Jose Villegas.
Yes, it is.
And I will need some shots of the vigil in Huntsville.
Okay,
and some of the
I'll find
speakers.
Someone. I usually stay busy meeting and greeting and on the microphone,
okay.
But I will find someone that is more camera literate than I am.
Yeah, Mark Pertle needs that for the show.
Okay, well, can Mark accompany us up here?
No, he's not even going to be here. The show's going to be shot here by Otis. But I may be able to find a photographer to go.
I would appreciate it. Just tell them to get in contact with me. You know my phone number.
Okay, thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Ray. And once again, thanks for execution watching. I'm sorry we have to meet like this.
Thank you, ma'am.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Pat Hartwell. She is with the Texas, let's get this right. She's with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. And if you will put that in your search engine, you'll get some action. Jim, were you to a breaking point? Somebody else?
No, that would be fine. What I thought we'd do next, Ray, I've asked both Laura
and Pat. Larry, did you have anything that you need to wrap up?
Unless you guys want to talk some more about procedural factors. I think we covered them pretty well.
Yeah, we got him from Cornell University. He seemed to be familiar with the law, not perhaps all the details of this case.
I was curious about what other jurisdictions are doing. You know, I'm not big on criticizing things unless you've got a better solution. I would love to find out what other jurisdictions are doing and how they're handling it, but it wasn't mentioned.
Well, we'll exploit that next time we catch a Ferner.
Okay.
Mike, what's cooking?
Well, I've been asked to talk about how the state countered what Larry talked about. Obviously, the state wanted their conviction to be upheld, and this is the trouble with the trial. At the time of the original trial, as already been talked about, the Atkin case had not been decided. The lawyers did not bring up the mental retardation issue because that was not an issue until afterwards. After he was convicted, Atkin came out. And the Atkin case said that you cannot execute a mentally retarded man.
Yeah, but that wasn't applicable when this case
exactly,
was tried.
It was afterwards, which is the reason for the writ.
Yeah.
So that's why the lawyer didn't bring it up, because it wasn't relevant at that time. But after Atkins, it was relevant. So Atkin says you cannot execute a mentally retarded man. The trouble is Atkins did not define what was mentally retarded. It took the Brisno case to define mental retardation and what it was. And what I'm going to talk about are the three things the Brisno case says shows mental retardation. And what I'm going to talk about is how the state handled those issues and showed it wasn't a factor. First of all, understand that the burden of proof on the defendant is beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's his burden of proof.
And he must prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Excuse me, beyond the preponderance of the evidence.
Okay, it's a civil standard.
I said the wrong thing.
Beyond
the preponderance of the evidence, which is 51% of the evidence.
Yes.
The first thing the Brisno case says is that the definition of mental retardation is the first sign of a sub-average intelligence. The trouble with this case is that if you want to take an IQ test of a man from Mexico, they did not do it when he was a child. They did not do it when he was in school. There's probably no records of the IQ test. So to give the IQ test to a man on death row, that if he does well, he's going to be executed, and if he doesn't do well, he's not going to be executed. The state argued that's not the IQ test cannot be used because that's not a fair indication. He might be failing it on purpose. The second thing the state said is that his drug use would cause his lack of IQ. Does not mean mental retardation. It means drug use, number one. Number two, the court said that the onset of mental retardation had to occur before you're 18. The trouble with a man from Mexico is you have no records, you've got no school records, you've got nothing to prove it came up before 18. In addition to this, the next thing they said is, again, as we talked about already, you have to show limited adaptive functionings, that he could not function. And what the state brought up in that is that he showed lots of adaptive functioning in that he escaped from prison in Mexico. He knew how to do it. He knew how to come to America. He knew how to get this job. And once he got this job, he planned out these murders, and he knew what he was doing. That is very strong evidence.
Except for the fact that he decided it was nap time in the middle of it.
Go ahead, Susan. You're going to say something about napping.
I don't think he decided in his childhood. People that knew him as a child apparently said sometimes he'd just fall asleep. I don't think he decided as a decision. I think after he bludgeoned a man to death and raped a woman twice, he fell asleep because he was exhausted. Physically exhausted wasn't a decision.
Necrophilia, perhaps.
Just tired.
The next thing that the DA argued was that in a prior case, he gave a false name to a police officer. And that shows rational thinking. Okay. So what you have is that no evidence that he was sub-average intelligence that they believed, no evidence we had before 18, and evidence that he knew what he was doing. Now, all of these things had to be decided beyond a preponderance of the evidence. The next question that Jim said is this decision has got to be made by the judge who ordered the execution. It is a tough job for a political official like a judge with a crime that was so serious and so horrible that it had been moved to another county, to have the jurors come back in 5 minutes and find him guilty, to come back later on and say, oh, he's got an excuse because he's mentally retarded.
In any case, Romero Hernandez is not dead. Whatever the plot and plan was, it worked because he's dead. They killed him a few minutes ago. And if you're listening to this program live on the Internet or over the broadcast, he's dead. My thing is that they, according to the professor, they had three qualified, experienced, expert witnesses come in and say the man was mentally impaired, and you had one guy that had obviously not read the rule book said, no, he's fine, and the judge considered in a preponderance of the evidence that one beats three.
And the problem with that is when it goes on to the appellate court, the appellate court will not overset what the judge ruled as long as there was some evidence.
It was a finding of the fact of the law by the judge, and that's the judge's prerogative.
And the fact that one person got up and said he wasn't is enough to rationalize what the judge did. So the appellate court was not a help. Then you go to the federal level. Well, the trouble with the federal courts is a case like this is all the federal courts determine is was it a reasonable interpretation of federal law, and they followed the law. The issues that we're talking about are
the law at the time.
Well, even the law when this was being reviewed.
Okay.
By now, Ackers was in, Bresner was in, and they followed the law. The problem becomes that as long as anybody says he's not mentally retarded and the judge finds that way, the appellate court can't reverse it. As long as they don't violate federal law, the federal court can't reverse it. And so the issue is really a tough issue to prove mental retardation on a man who we have no record before he's 18. We know nothing about his childhood. He didn't take an IQ test till he's an adult. And basically it becomes no evidence that he was mentally retarded before 18. And it becomes a very difficult case because of that reason. The big issue is how we're going to handle this in the future. As Jim mentioned before, you cannot have the judge who ordered the execution reversing himself.
There's no mechanism to change that except maybe the legislature takes 12, 14, 16 years.
You can't do that. So what we have to do is come up with some impartial people or panel to make this decision on mental retardation besides the criminal system. And there's been many suggestions tonight. Some suggestions talk about psychologists. Some suggestions talk about law professors. Some suggestions talk about religious people in the community. We have to have a standard to determine who is under mental retardation and who is not. And we have to be Christian and understand that people with limited mental facilities, punishment.
Well, you know, Harris County Jail is the largest mental institution in the state. Harris County Jail.
State Bar might be ahead of it, but go ahead.
Well, I know. I've heard you express that opinion before, but I don't have any empirical evidence to...
I do, but okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Why don't we trade places with Jack and get Jack Lee up here, because I want to get all of our cast involved here. I'll not ask Jack what is his opinion of State Bar. But, Jack, you and I were talking earlier, and I said... this guy was just a disposable person.
Sure. And it's, as far as the state's concerned, everyone's disposable. That's what happens when you have
China,
No, I think it's not just China, but I think people a large state has a tendency to believe that everybody is disposable.
Well, let me run this through your Oriental life experience.
All right.
Revenge is just violence, but it has a rationale. It's more justifiable than the original violence for which you seek revenge.
Sure.
How's that?
Well, I mean, I agree with you. But ultimately, is that the way we should look at our society and our state? I think ultimately, the penal system really serves only two purposes. I want to help you, and I hate you. The part that I hate you is, well, I want vengeance. It's the collective saying you did so badly that we want vengeance, and this execution is the ultimate form of vengeance by our society. And then the other part is rehabilitation. Well, if we put you away, maybe you'll learn your lesson, and now you can come back and we can reacclimate you to society so you can be a productive member. And that would be the I want to help you part. And I think we, as a society, we don't necessarily get we confuse the two issues very often and come out with mixed results.
I want to turn to the audience. I mean, I've got a lot of convicts out there that have already, you had dinner this afternoon at 3:30. That was your evening meal. And now you're back in your cell and you're listening to the radio and you're hearing Execution Watch. And you guys on the row may not have gotten dinner. It was poked through a hole in your cell door and it had human pubic hair all over it and you didn't want to eat it. But wherever you are and you're listening to this show, we would like to read your feedback. Is that fair?
Sure.
You'd like to hear from some of these convicts?
I would.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So, why don't you all take time out to use your copious supplies of correspondence material and write us a kite. Address it to Execution Watch. Or you can just put my name on the outside of it, Ray Hill. And send it to radio station KPFT, 419 Lovett, L-O-V-E, then two T's, L-O-V-E-T-T, Boulevard, Houston, Texas, 77006. We've been doing the show for a long time. We get a good bit of feedback, I do, from the free world people, mostly in Europe, who are really concerned about what's going on here. But I would like to hear from you so that we can share with the legal team and other folks, and it might have some impact on their coverage of the show. We've had a string of shows that have been amazingly similar. We've been talking about mental health and mental retardation around this table for the last three shows for sure. And next show, I've got Jose Villegas on the air, and Jose Villegas is a completely different person than who Jose Villegas was when the crimes were committed. Completely different person. And so we don't talk about that. We actually talk about the camaraderie, the mutual support of guys on death row, which I think is an absolutely fascinating subject. Yes,
Ray. Getting back to this theme of mental retardation and mental health, when I was looking over the Bersino factors, I couldn't help but think back to John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men.
Yeah, it occurred to me that this, of course, it didn't turn out to be a real ranch, but Of Mice and Men. You mean ranches?
Sure.
You think of Lenny? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is, in this particular case, Lenny was the one that did the killing. That's the problem. Last being, Lenny was the one that was killed.
Yeah.
It didn't work out that way, though.
Right. It's, Hernandez, it's hard, it's just really hard to convince somebody that was able to escape from a Mexican prison, was able to figure out, I need to get out of Mexico, otherwise I'm going to go back into prison. and he successfully makes it to the United States, crosses the border. It's real hard to convince people that you're retarded.
He also was apprehensive of law enforcement for obvious reasons, such as giving a false name.
No, I'm apprehensive of law enforcement.
Well, but, I mean, in other words, giving the police a false name, also telling the girl he raped, you know, not to tell anyone or, you know, threatening her to kill her. And also Ms. Lick testified that when he motioned like he was injecting his arm and he said he didn't care,
That happened before the trial.
She testified to that in trial. She said he did that during the rape process.
During the trial. He didn't care.
Made that gesture when he was raping her. He did that during the crime scene, and she testified to it at trial.
Oh, okay.
When he was doing all the stuff in the house, he did the activities injecting himself.
Okay, what are you going to do about those people? And I don't think they're all that uncommon. Who don't think that their life is worth anything. So whatever you do to me is matter. And the Pruitt case kind of begins there. And we're going to get to hear Robert Pruitt do it. Talk about that on the show. If I don't care about my life, then what difference does it make what I do to other people?
I'm not sure this would be applicable in this case. It might be in Pruitt, but in this case, I'm not too sure that's applicable.
Well, I don't think it's applicable.
You know, you've got some bludgeon killings in Mexico. You got raping young men. You got terrible killing here and raping a woman after he killed her husband. I'm not sure that's
applicable. Didn't his father call him a burro?
Yeah, but
him making that motion of a lethal injection in his arm and saying he didn't care would tell Miss Lick he didn't
care. I love you all,
but
I got to wrap up because the clock is gone. Thank you for listening to Execution Watch. My name is Ray Hill. I've been the host. Ramiro Hernandez is dead. We did the best we could to give you some insight into him. Jim Skelton has coordinated the work of the lawyers, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, and Jack Lee. I want to thank Pat Hartwell from Huntsville, David Atwood from Houston. The next execution will be Jose Villegas, which will happen 1 week hence. Listen up. Our technical director, Otis McClay, keeps us on the internet. Our video photographer is Mark Pirtle. Elizabeth Stein is the gal who puts all this together and makes it happen. And the voice you hear in the background is Victoria Panetta. You can find her, Victoria Panetti, you can find her at She Monster International. This is Ray Hill saying thank you.
Don't you know? Some accused are innocent. Some get good lawyers. Most don't.